You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weiner-Kent, and I'm here with...
Susie Evans, Senior Editor.
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And today, we're recording today of the Tony nomination. So we'll talk a little about that. We'll also talk about our, haven't spoken about it yet, our May-June issue on theater in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Chinese theater, which is an interesting international issue we did. And then we'll have an interview with Dan O'Brien, the playwright, whose play The House in Scarsdale is playing soon at the Boston Court Theater in Pasadena, California. It's part of a sort of trilogy, autobiographical trilogy, the first play of which was The Body of an American, the play about Paul Watson, which played at Hartford Stage, and I think, was it Primary Stages here in New York?
I think it was Primary.
In various places. It's the second play in a trilogy, which if you saw that play, that was partly about Paul Watson, the photographer, but then it was also, we'll talk about this interview, about Dan's own life, complicated, interesting life. So poet, playwright Dan O'Brien will be our guest today. So we'll start with the discussion of everyone's favorite real estate scam. I'm sorry, it's Tony Awards.
Rob hates the Tony Awards, yet somehow every year he usually writes the nonprofit theaters and Tony's piece for us. So
you
he
know,
really secretly likes it.
The Tonys are a fine excuse to talk about our art form. I'm fine with that. I just don't think they have any significance in themselves. But go ahead, Susie. Take it away.
I mean, I think they're significant. I think if we're going to be talking about the nonprofit angle, which we usually talk about, the nonprofit theaters did pretty well in the nominations this morning.
Yeah. And our start off, who's our special regional Tony this year?
It is Dallas Theater Center.
Nice.
That was announced yesterday, so we already knew that. But also, like, Lincoln Center got a bunch of nominations for its revival of falsettos and for Oslo.
Nice.
MTC got a lot of nominations for both Jitney and The Little Foxes.
Manhattan Theater Club, yes. Theater Club,
you know, yeah. Roundabout didn't do as well as it's done in past years, but The Price got Danny DeVito got a nomination for The Price, and Holiday Inn got a choreography nomination, so there's some love there as well.
And then almost time nomination for Ars Nova for Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812.
Well, it's the first time Ars Nova has been on Broadway.
Exactly. Right. So yay, go down 99 seats.
Just barely.
Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet has the most nominations of any show. They have 12.
Yeah.
So they're leading the charge, which was weirdly a lot of pundits this morning were surprised by that. I was not surprised by that.
I was not surprised.
No.
But yeah, and then almost all the shows, including musicals, had some start at nonprofits. I mean, Dear Evan Hansen, which has 9 nominations, started at Arena Stage and then Second Stage. All the new plays are by by American playwrights making their Broadway debuts. If you checked out our Broadway issue,
yeah. And all of the best play and best musical nominations started in the regions aside from Groundhog's Day.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yes, all the best play and musical. I was about to say The Present didn't either, but The Present didn't get a nomination.
No,
but Cate Blanchett got one.
No. A nomination, no.
Yeah. No, it was except for Groundhog Day, almost everything started somewhere, except for, I don't think Present Laughter did. So revivals.
I was talking about new play, new musical.
Oh, new play, new musical,
new
yeah.
Plays,
yeah. I haven't even looked
Six
at
Degrees of Separation, Press and Laughter didn't, but...
And Miss Saigon didn't, but that's...
And Hello Dolly didn't.
Yeah, that's fine, but... The new works.
The new work is really from the region.
As Garrett Eisler's wonderful piece for us pointed out, plays, and to a certain extent musicals, they're all being developed in the nonprofits. Right?
Yeah, I was really happy with a lot of the love that got put on A Doll's House Part 2. I mean, it didn't get nominations in a lot of the awards that came before this one, like Dramadesk and things like that for Best New Play, but it's got Chris Cooper, Condola Rashad, Laurie Metcalf, Sam Gold, Best New Play, got a lot of love.
And the playwright, right?
Lucas.
Best
New
Play. That whole thing where the Best New Play,
play
goes to the playwright, not the producer, but the...
But Best New Musical. Best Musical goes to the producer, not the writers.
Makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Doll's House is a unique one, as the playmakers pointed out. We spoke before, it was commissioned by South Coast.
Yeah, and it's at South Coast right now.
But this is an original Broadway, straight to Broadway production with not a tryout, not a, was not, de- I mean, I think there was some development that must have gone on for
some. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Lucas did some workshops.
Yeah.
But, and Lucas did developmental workshops with this cast too for Broadway.
But yeah, but as you pointed out, like Scott Rudin, the producer, basically gave him a resident theater kind of development process on the commercial dime, which is rare.
Yeah, I feel like
does South Coast get a credit in this?
No, it's not their production.
No, it's not their production.
It's not their production.
No. They did commission it. They commissioned into. I don't know.
And they're doing a production of it right now with a different cast.
They're not going to get
But they don't get a credit within the.
Not a producing credit.
No, but I want to go back to what Rob said about the best play, best new musical. It's because there's a best score and best book Tony, but there's no best script Tony for a play.
I know. It makes a certain sense, and yet it doesn't make sense.
Well, do you think there should be the play doesn't make sense. It should be split up with script versus production.
Does it disincentivize new play producers because they're not going to get that new play award? Like Scott Rudin will not get an award for best play, but if he wants to get a Tony, he could have to produce a musical
or a revival. Yeah. He'll get it for best revival of a play.
So the revival goes to the producer?
I think
not to the dead playwright. Or what if the playwright's alive?
I don't know.
These rules aren't consistent.
Listeners, what happens to the Tony for best revival of a play?
Well, Noah Coward won't get it, but John Guare could collect it.
His estate could get it.
Arthur Miller won't get it.
I don't know. I thought it was a pretty good list. I thought there were a lot of musicals that didn't get a lot of noms. Bandstand, I think, only got choreography.
Anastasia didn't get a lot.
It got Mary Beth Peale, who hasn't been nominated since 1985.
It's crazy. She's amazing.
I mean,
she wasn't the one who was in Grey Gardens. It was a...
No, that was...
Mary Louise Wilson, sorry.
Yeah. There was No Love for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. No Love for Significant Other. Mm. No Love for Oh Hello.
Yeah. I was going to ask you what the snubs were, and those are the snubs, right?
Those are some snubs. I'm a little sad about Significant Other. I know a lot of people that brushed it off as thin, but I thought it was a really profound
play.
Was
the reason they can't nominate... Five?
They can't nominate five. There's only four slots. You can do five if there's a tie. So last year there were five musicals.
Okay.
And everyone's like, oh, no five musicals. I'm like, it's actually rare that there are five musicals.
Yeah, that's pretty rare. Although there were a record number of new musicals this season.
There were, but apparently there were no ties in the nominating committee.
Yeah.
So a lot of new musicals. I mean, I think a lot. I mean, Holiday Inn at least got one. Bandstand at least got one. But like Anastasia got one or two, I think. Maybe more. But, you know. Some didn't get any.
Well, the obvious highlights, too, right, Susie?
Well, yes. I actually, the only category that I got 100% right in my predictions was the best new musical category.
Do we think the best play nominations are going to have an effect on the top 10 list going into the fall, just to keep it on our...
They'll have an effect for next year. I don't think they'll have an effect for this year.
Not this year.
Because these plays can't be programmed because they're on Broadway right now.
All right, sure.
You can't license it yet. Except Indecent has been licensed to the Guthrie for 2017-2018.
Was it Disgraced licensed right away or am I wrong?
But won't Indecent not be on Broadway at that time? Isn't it a limited run?
It's an open run.
It's an open run, okay. Yeah, Indecent is on stages for next season, but I mean, the plays, like when Hand to God was the top one, it was the year
after.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess they follow that stuff very closely.
So I guess they're banking on a decent closing.
Because I don't think Sweat has been licensed.
Sweat hasn't been licensed. No.
Another one that's been run through the regions.
I mean, but Sweat, even if it doesn't get the new play prize, the best play prize, though it should, like the Pulitzer will propel it to regional.
It's also hard with the best new play because you have Sweat, which has the Pulitzer, and yes, it has an excellent play, but like the other three, I don't think were up for the Pulitzer this year. Not that they would have won over Sweat. Sweat's excellent, but it's just like
the
timing and whether the Pulitzer will push it in. Anyway, I think there's some surefire wins and some open categories, and a lot of shows got snubbed, and there's a lot of love to nonprofits.
Sounds good. Peter Marks pointed out that all of them, except with the possible exception of Natasha, are really good for touring. I mean, best musical nominees.
And having a musical nomination will help them in touring.
Yeah.
Although Groundhog Day would be hard to tour. That turntable is.
Yeah, I guess so.
A lot of work.
He was also mentioning that he feels like I don't follow box office stuff at all, but he was thinking that the new plays were sort of eating each other at the box office. Like there wasn't a big enough audience for new plays, and they
is there ever a big enough audience for new plays?
Not usually.
Don't they usually just run at 60% capacity and close? That's why they close.
They don't usually run for open runs. Yeah.
And also, it's like what Garrett talked about. Like, this is why there aren't usually this many new plays, because they don't do well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the appetite is the for like one play to really run away and be a sort of a hit. I mean, new play.
Well, also, like, I just remember in past seasons having producers like Scott Rudin or other producers coming in and moving a show really quickly to Broadway because there weren't enough new plays on Broadway. So, like, this is a surefire win to get a Best Play Tony. Let's move Vanya, Masha, Sonia, and Spike immediately from Lincoln Center and get it. And then it runs away because it's really the only play on Broadway.
Right.
So now we have producers that are taking risks and putting more than one play on Broadway, but it's they're kind of cannibalizing each other.
Well, it's one place you can always get a short line is at the TKTS Play Us Only line.
Place you cannot get a short line is at the Rush ticket line for Hello Dolly at 1 a.m.
Okay. 1 a.m.
Or Sunday in the... Seriously?
I think you can rush Hello Dolly, and so you have to like wait till the box office opens. And it's like Shakespeare in the Park. People will sleep on the street.
Wow.
Or pay people to wait for them. There's a service that's really? Being provided
except
in New York
Hamilton
right now.
Doesn't let people do that.
Yeah, but if you want to see Sunday in the Park or Hello Dolly, just pay someone per hour and they
to
will
nap
stand
on the street.
Yeah, and they will stand. No, there's a service that.
What's it called, Deep?
It could be
Let's
a service, but they still
podcast.
Have to get there at midnight and stay on the street, so they're going to be sleeping on the street.
No, and someone did a video online for it on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. I have friends who've paid someone to wait in line for them for Shakespeare in the Park.
That's why God invented Craigslist. Though I was actually one snub for me, even though I don't see all of the Broadway shows, but I was very disappointed that Amber Gray wasn't nominated for Natasha.
Oh, I was
Pierre.
Too. Yeah,
yeah, like because Lucas Steele was nominated, and
I was surprised by that. Not that Lucas didn't deserve it, but
no,
I
feel like her performance. She
I was actually kind of surprised that Amber Gray didn't get one either.
Yeah, so that's my snub. And if Mamie Leanne doesn't win for best set design, then
she will.
Yeah.
Best theater design.
Theater design.
Well, I also feel like there's one female director in each directing category, and it's my opinion that both of them will win. So we'll
you
see.
Think Rachel and
I think Rachel and Rebecca will win.
Yeah, Rebecca Teichman, who directed
for
Indecent, and Rachel Chapkin for Natasha.
So we can translate this to the listeners.
To the listeners who don't know Rebecca and Rachel.
Yes, we profiled Rachel. I don't think we've profiled Rebecca Teichman. Have
maybe we should.
I think she's earned it. I think.
All right, well, this is another sample from our open editorial meeting here.
Do you want to come and talk to us?
So, anything? I don't think there's anything more to say about Tony's at this point. You can look for some coverage online. I won't ban all of it. Let's see. We should talk about our May June issue now on newsstands. And last week we put up the online package. Every May June for our WSU, we do an international theme. Last year we did Middle East, North Africa. I don't recall what the previous years was, and my memory doesn't go back that far.
It was South America, right? Like
Latin America.
Latin America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So sometimes it's a region, sometimes it's a theme. We've done themes about artistic exchanges and translation. This one, I thought, we have covered China before with various stories, reports from China, which we also shared last week, some interesting ones going back all the way to the 80s, Richard Schechner going to China and reporting on performance traditions there. But we've never done a whole issue just about China. And also, I spoke to David Henry Wong, the playwright here, who's done a lot of work in exchange with playwrights in China. So he's sort of an expert on that. We navigated the complications of calling it just China. Because without getting into the whole politics of the one China policy or the mainland versus Taiwan, the way I think I got around it with the title, we got around with the title was called a special issue on Chinese theater, by which we mean in the Chinese tradition and the Chinese language, or the languages. That includes mainland China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and as David Wong pointed out, Singapore. We didn't write about Singapore for this. These are the main Chinese-speaking regions of the world, and leaving national politics aside, to an extent, those are the ones we wrote about. I was happy to and proud to say Raymond Zhou, who's the sort of the main theater and film critic and a playwright himself in Beijing, at least English language writer, write a sort of an overview of the state of Chinese theater, which is a big ask. It's like asking, you know, David Cody or Ben Brantley, like, tell us all about American theater. Like,
in, you know, 3,000 words or less.
Exactly.
The history of American theater.
So...
I think he
didn't quite do a history, but he did a little thumbnail, and I think that was good. Then we also had, and he sort of downplayed the prevalence of Western musicals, Western style musicals, but we also had a piece sort of in counterpoint to that by Laura McDonald, who's a scholar, who has studied the, I would not say the resurgence or, but the, maybe the emergence of Western style musicals, both full on Western musicals going there in translation, as well as ones created for the Chinese market with sometimes American artists, John Rando and Mark Aceto, working on a sort of a jukebox musical for a Chinese pop star.
And according to Twitter, they got some amazing dumplings in when, while they were working on it, too.
Well, as you should. And then I think what were the other pieces we had were...
Your Stan Lai Q&A,
a big
which
Q&A
was...
A Q&A with Stan Lai, who's like
great.
A...
Great.
Yeah, thank you. A major artist who actually was educated partly here in the U.S. and works a lot in the U.S., works in San Francisco Opera, and had a big play at Oregon Shakes a couple years ago. One of his plays was brought, I think, the first English language production of it. Secret Love in Peach Blossom Land. Interesting artist. And then we also, I feel like we were missing a bit about the historical background. Raymond Joe touched on it, but I happened to hear another podcast, a little plug for our colleagues at HowlRound, the theater history podcast that Michael Luger does, happened to be right the week, right before our deadline, I heard a great podcast about the history of spoken drama in Chinese, the last century, like a thumbnail history with Siwan Liu, who's a scholar at Vancouver. And we basically ran a transcript of that podcast. I edited it down. And that was a fascinating bit of history, in part because we, as I think Raymond and other people talk about, you know, spoken drama is only a fairly recent in China, as we
Less
think
than
of
100,
it.
Yeah, about 100 years
100
old.
100 years old. And
yeah.
It's heavily influenced partly by the West, but also by Japan. I think they credit one of the first Chinese spoken dramas was done by Chinese students in Japan. So anyway, it's a fascinating window into a part of the world which you know, most Americans don't know much about.
And there's also some additional stories online as well. Yeah.
Yes. So there's also a great story about Hong Kong theater by Kent Smith, and one about Shanghai theater by Fei Cheng Wang Fei. I think you pronounce both her last name and his first name the same.
And wasn't there some talk about audiences within?
Yeah,
because like in China, I feel like China has like the same issue with as the U.S., where they have like a very big entertainment industry with television and film, and so like how does that kind of cannibalize audiences, and what is the role of theater within that system?
Well, one thing that felt familiar, and Susie wants to say, was that it Raymond talked about that it's not a huge audience. It's not even as big an audience in some respects as it is in the U.S. There's not as many performances. There's not a habituated theater going on. But what struck me was everyone spoke about this at some point. Stan Lai, I believe, Ken Smith in his piece about Hong Kong, and Raymond Zhou, is that it may not be a big audience. It's sort of an elite, self-selecting audience that's in the know in the big cities, but it tends to be young. This is something that everyone's been talking about, that it tends to be young. And I don't mean like millennial necessarily, but, you know, not...
Millennial isn't that young anymore.
Well,
not young. Susie's a millennial.
I'm a millennial.
But yeah. I think actually no one.
Are you
did,
saying
no,
I'm old, Deep?
No one put an age on it in our stories, but they just said that it was, especially American observers who are used to the sort of
silver-haired audience.
Yeah, you know, the predominance of maybe retirement age and around that age audiences here for American theater, that it was strikingly there's young people interested in. And Raymond Joe said that the audience is fairly aesthetically demanding. They want to see the envelope pushed. One area that it's maybe a small disappointment was that this issue did not go into politics very much. That's one envelope that they're not pushing very hard, with some variations. Both Stan and Raymond talked about ways in which they get around censors, around particularly sex issues and politics are two areas where you can make a statement, but it has to be oblique sometimes.
Well, it's kind of similar to what they were telling me about when I went to Moscow about because theater isn't as widespread of a medium, it means the government doesn't look at it as strenuously as it does on film or television. So theater artists have more room to play with the censorship laws and push the boundaries a little bit.
Right. And even if it's even this, whatever the size of the audience, it's not captured on tape unless someone wants to tape it. It's not captured and it's not printed on on pages or on a website. So it is harder to track it down. Theater, the liveness of it, makes it, more volatile, more interesting,
and that's why young people like it.
I think so.
Well, I think that's what the Russians told me.
Is it priced differently there for young people, or is the young people just doing better than our young people?
You know, that is one oversight that we did not talk about, the cost. I mean, there's definitely almost all the theater has some sort of state subsidy or state backing or state blessing to exist, but there's also a lot of entrepreneurial. Folks doing their own theater work. And it does seem like a lot of the more interesting theater, and this is true in various parts of the world that we've looked at internationally, a lot of the interesting theater is happening in academia, at colleges, in college theater departments. And I don't know, without getting too granular, I don't know if it's a similar thing that we have here where there's colleges with an equity theater attached to them, or whether it's from the photos I saw and from the way that they're talked about seriously, it's not just students in the productions, but it's colleges in which these productions happen. So anyway, it's not our last word on China. We found some great writers for this and we'd love to have some more. I should also mention a late advisor that came in to help us, especially with photos, but she also helped us with looking at the stories and consulting to make sure we didn't get anything wrong, was Claire Conseason, who's a noted theater, Chinese theater scholar. So she came in and helped us as a consultant. And again, as I say, not our last word on this area. Hopefully this is our introduction to more coverage of theater in China.
I learned
Chinese
a lot.
Speaking theater. Yeah.
I learned a lot. Yeah,
it was a good issue.
And now let's learn about Dan O'Brien and his play, The House in Scarsdale. I interviewed Dan this week and, it's an interesting interview. Enjoy. I can't remember how long ago it was that we spoke. Body of an American at Hartford's when we sat in the lobby and spoke. But how long
That's
ago was
right.
it? 2-3 years?
It was January, I think, January 2016. So
oh, not that long ago.
Yeah. It was. I mean, it feels longer for me because I've had cancer since then. But
that was what I was getting to. Since we met in that, there was no sign that this is all since then.
Yeah. It happened pretty much right after that production, because then the production opened in Hartford, and then it came to primary stages at the Cherry Lane.
Right.
And then I came home to New York, and I mean, home to L.A., and within a couple weeks was diagnosed. So
I know I was following on Facebook as one does.
Right. I was kind of mysterious at times on Facebook about what exactly was wrong.
Yeah, I didn't know the cancer, but I knew you were in the hospital and stuff was happening to you. So
yeah, it was an adventure.
You did say in a recent email that your NED, which I had to look up.
Yes. Yeah. No evidence of disease, which I guess is kind of like, you know, in the old days they used to say remission. They don't really say that anymore for reasons I don't really know. But maybe this is a better way to cover their bases. There's no evidence of disease, which could last forever, could last, you know, for a while. We don't really know. So it's kind of and my wife is in the same situation. She was diagnosed with breast cancer about 6 months before I was diagnosed with colon cancer. So she's also has no evidence of disease. So we're both just kind of trying to, you know, figure out how to live with, you know, I mean, we feel incredibly lucky, but of course we have a great deal of anxiety about the future, and we have a 3.5-year-old daughter. And
your wife is Jessica St. Clair. She's a actress and writer herself. Right?
That's right. Yeah. And she's got a TV show premiering that she co-stars in, co-writes, co-produces, directs a few episodes. And she's written for her character for this season a storyline that's really closely based on her experience with breast cancer. So we're both kind of, you know, trying to make some art out of it.
I don't want to
get sidetracked too much, but it's not really a sidetrack, and this is a big part of your life. But you're both, if I may say so, you're both pretty young to get both of those. Right?
Yeah, it's very strange. I mean, at least she has some history of it in her family. I don't have any history of it that I'm aware of. It is kind of strange. I mean, you know, we wonder. We'll never know, you know what I mean? But of course, we wonder. Jessica was living near the World Trade Center, and her apartment was covered in dust. And, you know, she and I were, you know, living there for maybe 6 months before we moved uptown. So we wonder about that, you know. But even then, it would be strange, I think, for us both to develop it at the same time. You know, even that's very odd.
What are the odds, right? That's weird.
I don't know. I mean, you know, part of the odds is that they're two of the most common cancers, you know.
Okay, and sure.
Going through this has kind of opened. I mean, we've had to get more educated, of course, about how common cancer is. I mean, we're young again for to develop it, but you know, they say something like, you know, a third to half of all people will experience some form of cancer in their lifetime. You know,
because wait, I mean, again, not to be too personal, but you're only around 40, right? Is that right?
Yeah. I was 42 when I was diagnosed. Yeah, and she was 39.
Yeah, yeah. Again, well, yeah. I'm glad to hear that you're both NED, as they say. And
thank you.
You alluded to something there that I think is relevant. We can jump into talking about your plays. This one is subtitled an autobiographical memoir or memoir and something like a memoir in. Wait,
yeah, I've been calling it a memoir for the stage.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Which I know sounds a little pretentious, but I feel like it covers my
So basis. You mentioned that you say there's no history in your family as far as you know. So I think that's a clue to what we're talking about with and this is a theme that runs through Body of an American.
Mm-hmm.
The story comes up there. It's gone into in great depth in this play, and then from what I can tell, New Life is also about that. So this plays the house in Scarsdale. This is the one that's going to Boston Court. This one goes right into, as I think we talked about it, even when you were working on Body of American, this goes right into the whole question of what's up with your family? Who are you? Who is your father? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it comes from a very, you know, fairly quick moment in the Body of an American, which again is another autobiographical play or very close to documentary theater, where my friend, this journalist, Paul Watson, said to me, because I, you know, I'd alluded to this mystery in my family about whether or not my father was my father, whether or not the man I was raised by was actually my father. And Paul Watson just suggested, well, why don't you just start asking questions? You know, being a journalist, his point of view was, you know, stop ruminating about it and start asking some questions. And because it terrified me, I knew he was right, and I wanted to write a play about that. So I spent a few years getting back in touch with estranged relatives of mine to try to do just what Paul Watson had suggested, which was to ask some questions and to try to almost treat it like I was a journalist trying to figure out specifically that question about my father, but even just larger or smaller questions about my childhood and my family things, because my childhood and my family in general was full of secrets and lies and delusions. You know, I think in many ways it's a story of mental illness, you know, and trying to sort of the play tries to peel apart, you know, what could the you know, the layers and the differences between what could be lies, what could be secrets, and what could be simply mental illness in the family. So yeah, I spent a few years interviewing, tracking down some strange relatives who were hard to find, specifically this one relative who I came to think could possibly be my father, and who I hadn't seen since I was 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And the family myth of him, my uncle Brian O'Brien, was that he was like totally off the grid, you know, that he would be impossible to be found. And it turned out he actually wasn't that, you know, this is spoiler alert, I guess, but I won't give away everything, but I did find him, and it was not as hard as the myth would have had me believe, you know.
And so do you get any closer to closure on that, just the factual point of that, or the play's not about that?
I mean, the play eventually became not about that. Yeah. I mean, I think I did get an answer without without putting the question to my uncle. And partly that was because I didn't want to scare him away. Right. You know, I wanted to keep him in my life. Partly is because getting to know him a little bit, I did get to know him. I felt like I had an answer.
And
I sort of wanted to keep the mystery alive, you know. So that's probably another challenging aspect of the play, is that we don't give the audience 100% answer. I mean, hopefully it's the sort of thing that people afterwards will want to, you know, debate. I don't even know with this production what decision the actors have made.
Right.
And I don't think the two actors know in terms of whether or not my uncle, my father's younger brother, could have could be my father. I know they've made choices of their own, but they haven't shared it with me or with each other.
Well, I do want to talk about the form of the play and the sort of way it's written and the way it's the stage directions. But I wanted to ask one more point about the paternity question. The thing that struck me was an amazing exchange. I'm adopted myself. I don't know if I told you that. So I've met my birth mother, but never my birth father. I was happily adopted, and I think of my parents as my parents, right? But this line at one point, when I think it's your step grandmother, Regina.
Right.
When she says, I think it jumps around a lot. Someone says, well, that's because of who your father is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my step grandmother, yeah.
And you say, wait, what do you mean? And the double-edged meaning of that struck me as you think she means who your father really is, like the real mystery guy you never knew. Right. And I think you take that, and she means it to mean who your father is, the person who raised you. In other words, she's saying what sort of person he was, who he was, or who he is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so the exactly.
Sort of bifurcation of who the father who raised you and the father who bore you, and the sort of mystery at the heart of it.
Yeah.
But uncovering who that man who raised you really is has a lot to do with obviously who you are.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in a larger sense, the play gives me a better sense of not only who my father is, but who my mother is, mm-hmm. who we were as a family, how we functioned or dysfunctioned as a family. Yeah. You know. But at the same time, some of those interactions did seem to have some ambiguity for me to continue to develop this delusion or this fantasy or this hope that my uncle could be my father.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it really was. There's a moment later in the play where my older brother says to me, you know, I float this theory by him, and he says, that would be so awesome, you know, if it were true. You know, so it was actually something that I was hoping could be true in a lot of ways because of how emotionally cold and abusive my father was, the person I was raised by was.
And
it's interesting, you know, so in some ways the play becomes more about storytelling and about how we, you know, we search for stories to explain who we are and where we come from. And, you know, the whole thing was sparked by being disowned by my parents and by extension by a lot of my siblings about 10 years ago without any clear explanation or clear understanding why. So suddenly I really felt like I needed a new story. You know, I needed a new narrative to understand who I'd been, because suddenly I was shocked. You know, I thought I was kind of the golden boy in my family, and suddenly I was the black sheep, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a shock 10 years ago. So, you know, this project and what turned into this play was an attempt to sort of retell or revise a story I thought I knew, you know, childhood.
The question I wanted to ask you was, you know, family is of course a huge theme of theater going back to the Greeks. But the classic American family play that we know is there's a Thanksgiving dinner or there's a wedding, mm-hmm. and people come together and they have big fights and they air their problems. And, you know, there's some great plays in that genre and there's other. Mm-hmm. This is not that kind of play. This is a family, but this is a play of sort of an investigative questioning play. But I'm specifically interested in the way this is true of Body of American too, where poetry ends and where theater begins for you. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, there's just one more thing. You mentioned a couple times in the stage directions, don't mime, don't drive, even though people are sitting in the car. There's like a stay away from any easy theater choices. Can you talk about your relationship to theatricality in your writing?
Yeah, I, in general, I just always want to be surprised.
Okay.
As I'm writing myself, you know, I want to feel like each play I'm writing is something strange to me that I'm discovering in the act of writing. So again, that's, you know, to my subjective taste, somebody else might see or read this play and find it not that strange or challenging. Other people, I'm sure, would read it or see it and find it very theatrical and or difficult or challenging. But, you know, for me, life is strange. You know, things happen that I don't understand, and I want to sort of capture that, you know, and I want to capture the mystery of that. I think I've been in a phase, I guess, just personally wanting to write very intimate stories that may have sort of wide-ranging, characters, you know, there may be lots of characters, but I really want to focus on two voices, and I want to focus on trying to dramatize internal states and, you know, with this play specifically, trying to dramatize memory. Things that, you know, when I teach playwriting, especially in the past when I thought I knew what I was teaching, I would say, like, that's a terrible idea to try to dramatize memory, or, you know, the flashbacks are kind of deadly, or you know, internal or audience direct address is kind of deadly. You know, those are things that are difficult, but that's also why I feel drawn to trying to do it. You know, both with The Body of America and this play, you know, it is so much about memory and consciousness and trauma, you know, with Paul Watson and his experience as a war reporter. You know, I felt like the play needed to sort of go deep into the psyche of this character. And to some degree into my psyche, because I was identifying so incredibly closely with his story. And then with this play, The House in Scarsdale, I said, okay, well, let's turn the lens even more directly on myself and, you know, and try to go deep into memory and consciousness, also into the memory and consciousness of the characters that I interview. You know, it was interesting. And the reason I call it a memoir as opposed to, I don't know, autobiography or something is because I'm interested too, and how we remember things and how we misremember things and how memory is an act of fiction and imagination to some degree as well, you know,
right.
Maybe fundamentally, you know, you know, in terms of poetry for me can go even deeper in terms of exploring consciousness and exploring the individual psyche. You know, I feel like I write poems like a playwright, and I probably write plays like a poet. You know, I like things that are sort of in between genre. Again, that's connecting to the idea of strangeness and how life, for me, doesn't always seem to fit very cleanly into different forms of expression, right, and understanding. So, you know, that's part of it too. And maybe at the end, it's really just being true to whatever my particular voice or talent is, you know, it does live somewhere in between plays and poetry.
Yeah, you know? It does, you know, your line breaks, I don't know, it reads like poetry. And I think that Body of America, the way it was staged, had that feel to it. I don't know if you know the writer Joy Gregory. She has a great quote, which I think is original to her. I've never found anywhere else where she says, "Playwrights are poets who got lonely."
That's great.
And I think there's a ring of truth to it. I wanted to bore deeper on that. How you know when something's, wait, this, I can't do this in a poem, I need to put this on stage, or this is theatrical, mm-hmm. and this is a, because I know that some of the material that's in Body of American is in your poetry. I mean, there's overlap.
Yeah, and that, and it, you know, at least interestingly to me, that began as a play first, The Body of American, and it sort of morphed into a collection of poetry called War Reporter.
Yeah, I've read some, yeah.
Which has a lot of overlap. There's probably a third of that book is pretty directly adapted, if not lifted, from the play. And, you know, it just sort of naturally developed where I just wanted to go again deeper into Paul's psyche and into sort of the episodic nature of Paul's story. Mm-hmm. And a play, obviously, even if it's a poetic play, you do have to, of course, care about dramatic action and storytelling. And so, you know, part of it was, you know, a 90-minute play can only cover so much of Paul Watson's life, for example, you know, and I just felt like I wasn't done with his story, you know. And I had to, over the course of revising it from what was probably originally a, you know, 2-hour and 15-minute play down to a 90-minute play, you know, I was constantly trying to find what was the most dramatic element of his story, the most dramatic way to structure it. So, you know, and it's kind of the same question with The House in Scarsdale, in that I've written lots of poetry about it, about my childhood, obviously autobiographical poetry. I've been working on a prose memoir, you know, for the last 2 years about my childhood that obviously has a lot in common with the play, but is very different, you know, in terms of how it works. And that the play, you know, The House in Scarsdale, what was different for me was that I was most interested in the interaction between the characters and trying to, you know, dramatize that, those meetings, those interviews, as opposed to, obviously in those interviews, they deal with a lot of history, family history and secrets and things like that. But what I was most interested in was doing the interviews.
Okay.
Was meeting, you know, was cold calling or cold knocking on the door of my step grandmother.
Yeah.
After 20 years, because my mother had sued her entire family and they were talking. And, you know, that to me was more meaningful. The writing was kind of secondary.
Wow.
And that's how I approach, you know, writing now in general, is that I want it to be something that I want my life to feel like the art first, if that makes any sense.
And that
the play and what I write is kind of secondary to it. I think when I was younger, I had this feeling of like, I'll sublimate everything to my writing and I'll create these wonderful works of art and I'll be a suffering artist. And I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I want the process, maybe it's cliche and corny, but I want the process of writing to be the most meaningful part of it.
Right.
So, you know, what was most meaningful to me was getting, you know, having the excuse. If I weren't writing the play at the time, I wouldn't have been brave enough to talk to these people, you know.
Yeah, that resonates with me. I think that makes sense. I mean, I think folks talk about that, that if there's things they can process in their art that they couldn't.
Right.
This is true of interpretive artists. I guess I hear it from actors too. That's a story they're putting on. This is your actual life that you're have an excuse. I mean, it's more than an excuse. It becomes a sort of mission or calling to go to those places, right?
Yeah, I like that idea of a calling or a mission because it does feel like. I think I was talking to Davis McCallum, if you know him, director, years ago when I was still first thinking about this, and he said what I was already thinking, which was, oh, well, you've got to write this play because you're terrified of it, you know?
Right.
And I absolutely agree with that idea. You know, it doesn't mean, of course, that we all have to write memoir or confessionally, but I completely agree that, you know, you should write about exactly what scares you, you know, and what feels most pertinent to what you're living, you know, the life you're living right now, which is why New Life, the new play, you know, has to involve what my wife and I have been going through with cancer, mm-hmm. year and a half.
You know, so I just had this, I got to confess, I had this, it's not a brain fart, I guess, but it's more like I saw Body of American at Hartford Stage, and I don't remember the name of the actor who played you.
Mm-hmm.
But
Mike Crane. Yeah,
right,
Mike
so
Crane.
In my memory, I was remembering I saw Dan in that play. That's uh-huh. literally what I was remembering,
oh,
even though that's, and I met you around the same time.
Yeah.
Which is funny. And I know
I try to cast people, you know, that are younger, better looking, but have the beard.
The beard is the most important.
Have to have the beard, yeah, exactly.
So, speaking of which, you sent me a video for the Boston Court production, and there's two guys, both with beards, a little age difference. What I'm getting at here is what is it about this form of having two voices that are sort of two Dans in a way. Are sort of the baseline. Then they play all the different characters throughout.
Mm-hmm.
But does one of them stay Dan? The young one always stays.
The young one's pretty much always Dan. I think there are a few places in the scenes where they're Dan talking to each other,
right.
Where they both can kind of morph very quickly into other voices and to other characters. For the most part, the younger guy plays Dan the whole time. He's sort of constantly chasing, you know, the answer to many questions, but specifically to the question of who his father is. And so each scene, he's kind of chasing the same character, the same actor in a way, in my mind, which is why that actor is always sort of transforming into somebody else until finally, you know, he seems to transform into the answer, which is my uncle, who you know, becomes the sort of grand mystery for the story. Ultimately, though, he's not really the answer either. You know, it really is to Dan's story, you know. All right. And you know, that's not obviously it's not a new idea, but that was sort of just a way to dramatize the internal conflict.
You'd said how much exciting it was and interesting to meet all these people, but obviously your impulse as a dramatist is not to, I want to cast a Regina, I want to cast a Darcy, I want to see these people recreated on stage in a realistic. Again, I don't know if that's a strangeness you're reaching for. Or you want to capture something about the way that these experiences play off in your brain, and it's like Dan talking to Dan and processing it.
I think so. I mean, I think in some ways it's more honest for me, you know, because even though these interactions were all on the record and everything, these interviews, you know, some of these were hours long. Some of these were, you know, these interactions and I adapted them into sometimes 5-minute scenes or 10-minute scenes. So while I've tried to keep, you know, much of the action and much of the language of what was said, of course I've heavily adapted it. And of course it's coming through this filter of my own sort of needs and desires. And, you know, so there's something kind of more honest about having, you know, another actor play all of these characters and sort of say subliminally to the audience, like, you know, this is still not real. Even though we're trying, even though this is a memoir, this is still not, you know, reality. You know, of course, a different play could have cast these, you know, all these different characters with different actors and could work fantastically. But yeah, I was very curious and am very curious and interested in how, what my perception is and was of my relatives and what they were telling me. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's just an interesting form. I think you've sent me a bit of the next play, New Life, and that also has two. It's like this is a form that it seems like a form. Formally, you're attracted to this two men on stage telling a story.
I mean, in dialogue with each other. Yeah, I am for this. What feels like a trilogy.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Obviously, The Body of an American is so. I don't know, geopolitical in some ways, that it feels very different from my memoir, you know, it is obviously. But I still think of it as the memoir as part two in a trilogy. And then this new play, which I'm calling right now, New Life, is part three. So, you know, I've been working on a few commissions for theaters that don't use this form at all. And it's kind of a relief. To have eight actors and a totally different style. So it's, you know, I don't want to feel locked into to writing in any certain way. This evolved naturally and organically for me. And I, you know, part of the story of New Life is about me learning to stop writing about Paul Watson, you know, about me learning to move past, hopefully move past and move on from, you know, a certain phase in my life. And I think by extension, a certain way of writing probably too, you know.
Right, right.
I've never wanted to write the same way all the time. Do you know what I mean? I think, you know, I remember years ago hearing somebody, I think, told my agent, and I think it was a criticism, that I was like a real chameleon of a writer.
Okay.
And I think he said something like it. This was meant as a criticism, but I think I took it that way at the time. But I sort of agree in the sense that I do want to feel like each play and maybe each trilogy of plays demands its own form, you know, depending on what you're writing and the subject demands its own form.
But if you don't want to write the same thing every time, but you do have, in this case, three plays in this material, and so there's some formal consistency in this way this plays out. But then, as you say, it's a relief to try something else. So, have you or Michael McKetty told them stop imitating Dan, or no?
Yeah. Or
so you're not playing. You're not playing Dan O'Brien. You're playing.
Good question. I haven't even thought about it with this production because with The Body of an American, I certainly got used to like the sort of sneaky imitation that would sometimes like slip in. Mm-hmm. You know, there was never, or even just, I mean, now we joke about it with the costuming because the costume designers are always just kind of, you know, taking surreptitious pictures of what I'm wearing and then it shows up on stage. And so it's probably the height of narcissism, the whole right. Experience. But this time, I don't think, now I'm going to pay attention. I don't think Brian Henderson, who's playing me, I don't think he's doing kind of a me, but he might be. The productions I've been involved with, like of The Body of an American, we've always said, like, don't, and same with Paul Watson, like, don't go for, you know, an imitation. But right, if there's some, right. there's some of these people that you find helpful or you know, or interesting to as an actor in your interpretation, sure, go for it.
Right,
you know,
right.
I think the most horrifying experience I had was the premiere production of The Body of an American. We had a dialect coach come in, and with no warning, she started dissecting my accent and the way of speaking. And we were, you know, that was not the plan because we weren't trying to imitate it, but it was kind of cool, but it was also terrible to have somebody, you know, talk about how I slur my S's or, you know, she kept saying, suggesting to the actor playing me to slurry your speech like Dan does.
So wait,
know?
This was in your presence, you heard
yes.
her doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
Did the director say at some point, maybe clue it on that?
Yes, Bill Rausch is a great director and very...
Oh, Bill Rausch, okay.
Yeah. Very gentle,
yeah, that's right,
man.
That's
right. Sort of gently guided her away from it. I remember the other thing she said is that the reason I slur my speech a little bit is that I have a Zaftig lower lip,
Zaftig?
which I never even thought about. But I guess I do have a bit of a, you know, bit of a fat lip. so I feel
that's
for actors.
So weird.
It was very, and that actor Danny Wallahan, who did a fantastic job with that production, he did do a little, I mean, we never talked about it, but he slowly did do kind of a Dan O'Brien impression, okay. to some degree.
I know Danny, Bill Sawyers too, both those guys. That was, yeah. Portland Center Stage, was it?
That no. was at Portland Center Stage. Yeah,
okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I would love to have seen Bill. I loved
Bill's great.
Michael Compsey, but Bill would have been fun to see. Mm-hmm. As Paul Watson, mm-hmm. as well. Anyway, wow. That's great, Dan. Well, I wish I could see this. I'm sure it'll make the rounds, right? This play.
I hope so.
I mean, it's about New York. It should at least come to New York, right? It's got the Scarsdale in the name.
You think there'd be enough people in New York going to the theater that would have a connection to Scarsdale or Westchester or something? So we'll see. I mean, there's definitely been some interest, and in, you know, hopefully this production will get some more interest. So fingers crossed. Make some calls. We'll
yeah.
see.
Sounds good. Sounds good, Dan. I appreciate your time.
Of course, I thank you for the conversation and for the interest.
A total pleasure. Yeah, and I'm glad, you know, it's been such a short time since we spoke. Your life was turned upside down, and now you've landed on your feet again. I guess, right? Things are back to
normal.
That's
what it, yeah. Knock on wood. That's what it feels like. I mean, and that's what the doctors say. So we'll keep moving forward with that. Faith, you know.
And we'll have to, I mean, the question of course people must ask you is, well, these plays are really dramatic, a lot of stuff in them. Are you going to write about this past year at some point, about cancer?
Yeah.
And all that? Yeah, is that going to find its way into your work?
I mean, that's definitely a big part of New Life, the play with Paul Watson. And the play, I had already pitched and been commissioned to play for Portland Center Stage to write a sort of experimental rock opera about Sasquatch and cancer before I got cancer. So that's also on the table right now. So
the rock opera about Sasquatch, that rings a bell. Maybe you told me about that before. That sounds amazing.
I think it was in my bio at the Primary Stages production, or at Hartford in Primary Stages. So maybe there was a reference to that. Of course, I haven't written it yet. So, but I'll definitely be writing about this experience as much as I can, God willing, you know.
Sounds great, Dan.
Thank
Pleasure
you.
To talk to you.
It's great talking to you.
All right, we're back with some recommendations and other things to talk about. I'll start with one thing we didn't talk about on the podcast today was our ongoing coverage of the critical bloodbath happening at least in, we know this is national, but in recent weeks, it seems like in recent months, we had Charles Isherwood gone from the Times, Jesse Green hired, and even though that was a hiring news, it was the news that a lot of other people weren't hired for his position at the New York Times. And then in quick, just like startling
like
succession.
In a week.
Yeah, in quick succession, Linda Weiner announced that she was going to leave Newsday at the end of this,
Tony season, right now.
And after she's been doing theater criticism as long as I've been alive, basically, like literally. Then David Cody was laid off from Time Out, or restructured from Time Out New York, end of last week. So you can go online and read my Q&As with him. This is not a series. I enjoy talking to my colleagues, but I hate this reason for talking to them. Like, why are you leaving?
No, you're now the go-to theater critics leaving reporter.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I'm the go-to critics coming in as well. I did Lydia Janik when she started at San Francisco Chronicle, Jesse when he came in at the Times. Hopefully there'll be other ones to report. Maybe New York Magazine when they hire a new person there.
Entrances and exits.
Are they hiring a new person?
Yeah. We'll see. I've heard that they're looking for someone. In any case, I don't want to go into a big thing about discussion about that. I would just say that my recommendation this week is Linda Weiner, in addition to being a wonderful critic, unfortunately you can't read of a lot of writing because it's behind a wall at Newsday or garbled. But what you can find, watch her at work and her intelligent probing mind. You just go to YouTube. There's a League of Professional Theater Women did a series. I don't even know how long she did it, how many there are. It does seem like a bottomless a hole you can fall into if you want. Just Google Women in Theater and Linda Weiner. She has interviews with Janine Tesori from like when Violet first came out, Ellen Stewart, Susan Laurie Parks.
Oh, I've seen some of these, yeah.
They're wonderful. Linda brings a lot of her, you know, personality and point of view to these. It's not just just turning over the mic to the woman. Lynn Nottage from, I don't even know what year, Intimate Apparel. It's a wonderful look back, and it's a reminder that I think overlooked a lot is that, you know, she was a critic at the Chicago Tribune for a long time. And then
She worked with Claudia Cassidy, right?
She didn't follow Claudia Cassidy, but
she didn't follow her, but say she was one of her mentors. I think Claudia was to Linda.
I'm not sure.
I'm pretty sure on that.
She definitely cites Claudia as someone that was very influential, but in any case, she was the only female first string critic at a New York magazine at a New York publication for quite a while, from the late 80s till about 2000.
Is there one right now?
There's not right now.
Yeah.
Variety.
Marilyn Anastasio. Yeah. There's some question about.
There used to be Alyssa Gardner, but she's not at USA Today.
Alyssa Gardner, USA Today. And Elizabeth Vincentelli for a brief shiny moment with the New York Post.
Yeah. Why don't we interview Elizabeth when she left the New York Post?
It was a while ago. I don't know.
It was like a year
ago. I wasn't on
the
beat yet. I wasn't on that beat. In any case, that's
a
recommendation.
Sorry, Elizabeth. That doesn't mean we didn't like you.
You can look at those aspiring stories online. And also, please look at some of the interviews that Linda did. They're wonderful. And, you know, they're worthwhile not just for her, but obviously for the people she covered. You know, this field, in this field, we are only as good as the people we cover. And luckily, we have great people to talk to. So what else do we have? Susie?
Yeah, I was going to recommend Annie Baker's The Antipodes, which I really liked. I think it sold out for the entire run, though, so I don't know if you can get to see
it. It got extended at least once.
It maybe got extended.
It got extended twice.
But then I could also recommend A Doll's House Part 2, which I loved. So see The Antipodes. It's amazing. I know a lot of people who don't like it, but I like it. I think it's a really interesting meditation on work culture and, you know, power dynamics in work culture.
And also creativity.
And creativity. Yeah. I mean, as someone who works in a somewhat creative field, like brainstorming does feel like that sometimes. So it was really interesting. And I think there's a lot to take away from it. It's a nice meditation on that. But A Doll's House Part 2 is also really excellent. And I left feeling very confused about how I felt about feminism and things. And I just didn't know it was so smart. And Lucas can argue both sides of any argument to like the nth degree. And I will recommend this. I had never seen A Doll's House or read A Doll's House. So I read the play right before I saw A Doll's House Part 2. And I actually do recommend that. It was actually really good to have like just read A Doll's House, even though like you don't need to know A Doll's House for it. It like made a lot of the like points land harder. Anyway, it basically picks up 15 years after Nora left. It's set in that same time period, and it's basically a argument on the validity of marriage. And it's really interesting.
It's a hearty door slam for Doll's House Part 2.
It's good. And also, like, you hate Helmer so much. That's his name, right? Helmer in the book.
Torvald.
Torvald. You hate him so much in the book, and you don't hate him in this. You see where he's coming from, and it makes you kind of mad because you want to hate him.
Yeah, Susie was giving me her live take as she was reading it.
He's a pretty terrible human.
Seen productions where he's humanized. I mean, he's certainly very sexist in the Doll's House, but it's not a simple.
Well, yeah. Chris Cooper is also such a likable actor, but it's
So
see it.
I can't wait. I'm seeing next week. And Deep?
This isn't so much a recommendation to see a show as it is just like something I've been thinking about and I think creators should be thinking about. I saw John Doyle's production of South Pacific last...
You mean Pacific Overtures?
Blah.
That's quite a mashup. South Pacific Overtures. I want to see that one. But go on.
I'd watch that. Someone do that. So I saw John Doyle's production of Stephen Sondheim and John Wideman's Pacific Overtures at Classic Stage Company. While I can't vouch for actually liking all of that production, it made me look into how John Wideman, Stephen Sondheim wrote Pacific Overtures and why they decided to write it in the style that they did. Because in the grand scheme of white men writing about Asians, Pacific Overtures is actually quite good and not offensive and not exotifying, which is really nice, actually, to not be seen as a place where it's mysterious and exotic and its people are, you know, mysterious and exotic as well. And I think the reason for that is because they very specifically chose to make the story from a Japanese point of view. And so you're seeing the world through those eyes, which means that you, as an audience, you don't have a white protagonist to follow. Like, it makes you empathize with people who you might not know in a nation that you might never have visited. And I think that there's something really beautiful in not giving audiences an easy out in that way. And I think there's something really, really profound, and it kind of gets into like what theater can do, which is like make you empathize with bodies in the room.
I'm seeing it tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to it, even though they could cut chrysanthemum tea. I don't know how that's going to work.
And I have a love-hate relationship with like the minimalism
of John Doyle.
Yeah.
Did you see the what was it called, The Visit?
Yeah, I did too.
I
think Susie fell asleep during the visit.
Oh yeah,
I fell asleep during the visit.
I mean, you know, it's right for
Susie
some things.
Susie falls asleep during a lot
it's
of shows.
It's right for some things.
Compared to Passion or Pacific Overtures, like The Visit was opulent.
Yeah,
because Passion, like they were just like, you know, screwing on the floor.
Right.
I saw Passion,
and they were screwing on the floor.
I think I fell asleep during that one too.
I fell asleep during the original production of Passion in 94 on Broadway. So that's one reason it's my least favorite Sondheim. Pacific Overtures is one of my favorites, as I've said before.
Such a good score. And the thing is, like, I didn't know this, but John Wideman he majored in East Asian studies in college. So he knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff.
That's all you really want at the end of the day is just someone who like really knows it intimately to write about it and not just like parachute in and then come out again.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. No, it's interesting.
People be more like John Wideman if you're going to write about other people's cultures.
This is the pronouncement. That's a good recommendation. I think with that, we have another award-winning show. All the links to what we talked about will be on the show page. You can rate us in iTunes. It helps people find the show. Are we on Stitcher and other things like that?
Yeah,
we're everywhere. American theater is everywhere.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.